Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the President's pledge in Poland to bolster NATO with a $1 billion boost to military deployments in Europe. A leading specialist on the politics and economics of post-communist Russia, Daniel Treisman, who is just back from Russia, joins us to discuss Russia's threat to pull out of the 1997 NATO-Russia Founding Act if there are major NATO deployments in Eastern and Central Europe, and whether or not there is an appetite on both sides for an increase in defense spending or a new arms race in Europe as former Warsaw Pact countries grow increasingly nervous of Russia following its invasion of Ukraine. Then we'll look into how Republican operatives have organized soldiers from Sergeant Bergdahl's former unit and offered them up to the press to criticize the American POW who was swapped by the Obama administration for Taliban prisoners. Robert Creamer, a longtime political organizer and strategist and author of Stand Up Straight, How Progressives Can Win, joins us to discuss his article at the Huffington Post, The Despicable Republican Attack on an American Prisoner of War, and why the mainstream media have enabled the attacks on Bergdahl, who, if he is, as it appears, a deserter, will be judged by the military. But in the meantime, the POW is being smeared in the right-wing press as a way to attack Obama. Then finally, we will speak with Scott Savitt, a former Beijing-based foreign correspondent who covered the Tiananmen Square massacre 25 years ago for the Los Angeles Times and United Press International. He joins us to discuss the media blackout in China on this June 4th anniversary and whether the Communist Party leaders have erased the pro-democracy movement entirely by encouraging nationalism and generating an economic growth, improving the standard of living to the point where the average Chinese citizen today has 20 times the income they had 25 years ago. And joining us now is Daniel Treisman, who's a professor of political science at the University of California, Los Angeles, and a leading specialist on the politics and economics of post-communist Russia. He's a recipient of the fellowship from the John Simon Guggenheim Foundation and the German Marshall Fund of the United States, and is the author of two previous books on Russia, the latest of which is Return, Russia's Journey from Gorbachev to Medvedev. Welcome to Background Briefing, Daniel Treisman.
Hi, happy to be here.
And Daniel, you were just back from Russia, and I'm trying to get a sense here of whether there's any kind of buyer's remorse in Russia following the outpouring of nationalism and fervor during the annexation of Crimea and into this whole confrontation with Ukraine, where of course Putin has shot right up in the polls. But it appears lately, in fact, today in Poland, President Obama went out of his way to say that he wants good relations with Russia and understands their concerns about their borders and their neighbors. And my understanding is that actually Putin and Obama have a pretty good relationship and talk often on the phone. So is this thing starting to wind down a bit?
Well, it definitely felt to me in Russia that there was a desire on the part of many people, but including Putin himself, to at least stabilize things and maybe get back to slightly more normal relations. I heard Putin talk at the St. Petersburg Economic Forum about 10 days ago. He gave a big speech in which he seemed comfortable, relaxed, somewhat combative. He made his usual jokes. And he gave the usual narrative about how badly he's been treated, how disrespectfully he's been treated by the U.S., Europe, and the Ukrainians now. But his tone was one of, I'm magnanimous. I will deal with this in a civilized way, and I hope that we can get back to normal. So I think he would like things to calm down, but that doesn't necessarily mean that he's going to give up on anything, or he's made his point that he can destabilize Eastern Ukraine whenever he wants to, and he'll still have that capacity even if things do return to a somewhat more normal basis.
But Russia have said that they will pull out of the 1997 NATO-Russia Founding Act should there be major NATO deployments in Eastern and Central Europe. And the president announced in Poland on Tuesday that the U.S. is boosting deployments with a $1 billion fund, which doesn't, in the real world, doesn't amount to an awful lot. So what's your sense of whether or not this thing is going to start, there's going to be a action-reaction, not obviously an arms race like the Cold War, but if the former Warsaw Pact countries are nervous about this newly assertive Russia, will they spend more and will, therefore, Russia spend more?
Well, it's been pointed out in the last few months that the NATO members other than the U.S. have mostly been spending less than they're supposed to under the agreements. So they, especially during the global financial crisis, Europe has been really trying to cut back on military spending. At the same time, the East European countries closest to Russia, in particular the Baltic states and Poland, are understandably very nervous about the precedent that Crimea sets. And I think everybody recognizes that we live in a new, much more uncertain world where you simply can't assume that Putin won't do something that has very large potential costs because he's already done that. So I think there's a great desire by all the many of the East European countries, not all, some of them are actually quite supportive of Russia, but many of them to have the U.S. spend more and deploy more military in their countries to provide a visible commitment. But I don't know if we're going to see very big increases in military spending in those countries. And to be honest, you know, even a 5% increase in military spending or even a 20% increase in military spending in Lithuania or Estonia isn't going to make a huge difference. As it is, though, I should say, NATO has an overwhelming superiority compared to Russia across the board. Russia clearly has a superiority on the ground in specific places when NATO isn't mobilized. But NATO spends in total about $1 trillion a year. Russia spends less than $100 billion on the military. So it's 10 to 1.
So, again, I'm speaking with Daniel Treisman, who has been a long-time specialist on politics and economics in post-communist Russia. He's a professor of political science at the University of California, Los Angeles, and a recipient of a fellowship from the John Simon Guggenheim Foundation and the German Marshall Fund of the United States. And he's the author of two previous books on Russia, the latest of which is Return, Russia's Journey from Gorbachev to Medvedev. So, in your meetings in Moscow and St. Petersburg with Russian officials, did you get the feeling that anybody has quite figured out what happened here? Was this an impetuous act on Putin's part, seizing Crimea? Had he invested too much in Yanukovych? Was he caught by surprise when the people rose up and kicked Yanukovych out? I'm just not sure of what happened here, whether, because much has been made about it, and everybody's now talking about Putin being a 19th century Russian imperialist, but it may be there's some simpler explanation. He just got freaked out.
Well, yeah, I can't pretend that I have sources very close to Putin, but the general impression that one gets from looking very closely at what happened and talking to some people in Moscow close to what's going on, the sense one gets is that it really wasn't a planned action. Obviously, they had contingency plans for various possibilities, but everything suggests that Putin made this decision quite suddenly, without broad consultation with people in his government or other advisors, that it happened right after the deal that had been negotiated between Yanukovych, the Ukrainian president at that time, and the opposition leaders, when that deal fell apart. And Putin had apparently persuaded Yanukovych to accept that deal, which would have eased the way to Yanukovych leaving power as the new elections approached, or in the interim would have meant a deal for cooperation, a coalition government, and so on. That deal fell apart. Putin felt betrayed, from what we understand, by the West for not pressuring the opposition to stick to that deal. And he felt a very strong action was necessary, and he chose the option of Crimea, as we saw. But even then, various indications suggest that they hadn't decided to actually annex Crimea. The initial plan was for Crimea simply to become a sort of independent state, or to declare independence and have this unclear international status. And then, improvising along the way, they came to a point where they decided that they would actually accept Crimea as part of Russia. But so it seems to have developed through a sort of complicated contingent set of events, and it really doesn't look like the unfolding of some master plan for expansion that Putin has been secretly developing for the last 14 years in power.
So what's the sense, though, in Russia? Obviously, there are sort of two Russias, the one that looks inward and the one that looks outward to the West. And at this point, we're told that the more nationalistic majority has the upper hand, and that the pro-Western liberals are all kind of they've been totally marginalized by Putin. He's taken away taken control of the press. Now he's taking over the internet. There's pretty much nowhere for them to go. But are Russians concerned about the negative views that the rest of the world has? The BBC just did a poll from their World Service saying that negative views of Russia now average 45% across most of the countries in the world that they've polled, with the exception of China.
Right. I think, and I can only judge from what I saw in St. Petersburg and Moscow on this last trip. I don't know if people are, it varies. Among people in academic circles, the intelligentsia in Moscow, the circles where I have most friends, a lot of people are very unhappy. They're disgusted, ashamed at this latest move in Crimea. More people are talking about leaving, or actually have plans to leave, or at least buy an apartment somewhere else to have a place abroad than ever in my time of going to Russia. So there's a sense of uncertainty, really disagreement with the foreign policy. At the same time, overall, you feel a great desire for normality. And you might get a sense from the West that people are all huddling around their TVs in Moscow or waiting for the latest bulletin and so on, but not at all. Life continues very, very normally in the streets. There isn't this sense of any aggression towards the U.S. or the West. Moscow's full of American tourists. Everybody seems delighted to have them there. It's just a much more casual atmosphere than I had expected going over there. And I think that's based in part on just a desire to get over this and to get back to normal life. But the economy is going to get worse. It was getting worse before the latest events in Crimea, and although the sanctions themselves haven't had a huge impact, the additional uncertainty they've created for investors, I think, will continue to mean capital outflows, poor growth performance, and that's I think, what people are most afraid of.
So back to the president's meeting in Poland, where he had dinner with the Ukrainian president-elect Petro Poroshenko and also the Hungarian president and the Belgian foreign minister, along with the Polish president, who was hosting the dinner. And on Thursday, of course, the president will be in Brussels for the NATO meeting, and then there'll also be the meeting in France for the commemoration of D-Day, at which it's expected the president will spend some time with Putin. He also mentioned in his press conference in Poland that François Hollande and the British Prime Minister would hopefully also talk to Putin about trying to, you know, get past this crisis and mend fences. But, you know, the real basket case in this is Ukraine, isn't it?
Ukraine is in trouble, and the West has made promises to provide economic aid. It needs serious economic aid. We didn't realize until we saw all of this unfold just in what desperately unstable state the state was. Just the failure of the Ukrainian army really to, until now, fight with any success against what were mostly just local volunteer troops really says a lot. And the ineffectiveness of the state, where these local oligarchs are really the only source of power at the moment that seems to be functioning, has really really come as quite a shock. So there's a huge job rebuilding the economy of Ukraine and creating an effective democratic state there, and we don't know if that's going to happen or not. Poroshenko obviously wants to try and make a success of it. He's going to have to negotiate with the Russians. I think the Russians will negotiate with him. Putin in St. Petersburg said quite clearly that Russia would respect the outcome of the election, that they would deal with the new authorities, even if they didn't think that Yanukovych was removed in a constitutional way. Nevertheless, they would move on. So there's a lot to be done, and we'll see how it goes. It'll depend on a lot of Western financial support, but at the same time, Putin probably doesn't want it to be seen to be a success. So it's a very delicate, difficult task.
Well, already, though, Russia's giving Ukraine more time to pay for the outstanding gas bill, which is something around $3 billion or something?
It keeps changing.
Yeah, it keeps changing, yeah.
They've reduced a bit of it. They also reduced the price back to, I think, $385 or something around that, $385 a 1,000 cubic meters. A lot of the bill depends on all sorts of assumptions that they choose to make or not to make about the past contract. So it's hard to keep track of the exact amount. But it does suggest, as you indicate, that there is a desire at this point, and it may be just while these meetings in Europe are taking place, to avoid a real showdown over the gas.
Or it seems like everybody's sort of backpedaling too. I mean, I don't know that this deployment of the extra $1 billion that Obama has announced is going to meet the threshold that the Russians are warning about pulling out of NATO on. It sounds like $1 billion is not going to – and frankly, I'm not even sure why – you know, NATO may be outspending Russia 10 to 1, but it doesn't seem to be – much of a military threat, I'm trying to navigate here between Russian propaganda and the reality. Right. You know,
I don't think realistically it's a military threat to Russia. Although when you do have that big imbalance and you have a military alliance moving closer and closer to your borders, it's clear why people would feel uncertain and uncomfortable. Nevertheless, I don't think it's a serious military threat. At the same time, Russia has a obvious local advantage in that it can move its troops in fast across the border, and it has proved to be really effective in this kind of new warfare where you send in unmarked troops very quickly, quietly. You use massive propaganda at the same time, and you change the facts on the ground without actually having to invade with tanks and so on.
But, right. You use the GRU and the KGB or the FSB. Right. Not surprising that a former KGB officer is in charge. I mean, everybody's pretty much thinks that Putin pulled off an extraordinary operation, particularly in Crimea, but it feels a bit like it's all backfiring a little on him now.
Well, it's also the case, it seems pretty clear, that a lot of what's going on in the eastern Ukraine is not under complete control of the Russian authorities. There's volunteers there, these diehard nationalists who've been volunteering in all the failed state conflicts like Transnistria and Moldova, Chechnya and so on, who just turn up where there's fighting going on. So there's that, and there's also now this so-called Vostok Battalion, which is made up of some Chechens and various other volunteers, apparently sent by Kadyrov, president of Chechnya, to go and help out and make trouble in eastern Ukraine. And it's not clear that all of that, in fact, it's very unlikely, I think, that all of that is really under the control of the Russian forces. It was much, much more unified, coherent operation in Crimea.
Well, Daniel Treisman, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Daniel Treisman, who's a professor of political science at the University of California, Los Angeles, and a leading specialist on the politics and economics of post-communist Russia. He's a recipient of a fellowship from the John Simon Guggenheim Foundation and the German Marshall Fund of the United States, and is the author of two previous books on Russia, the latest of which is Return, Russia's Journey from Gorbachev to Medvedev. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into how Republican operatives organized soldiers from Sergeant Bergdahl's former unit to smear him. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Robert Creamer, who is a longtime political organizer and strategist and the author of Stand Up Straight, How Progressives Can Win. He is a partner in Democracy Partners and a senior strategist for Americans United for Change. And he has an article at the Huffington Post, The Despicable Republican Attack on an American Prisoner of War. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Creamer.
Good to be with you, Ian.
And my understanding is that the news reports that have come out subsequent to the president's announcement of the release of the POW in exchange for some Taliban prisoners headed at Guantanamo, that the people from Sergeant Bergdahl's unit that have come forth have all been organized by Republican strategists.
Well, I'm not surprised. I mean, their first line of attack was that this was somehow negotiating with terrorists, and that would make this kind of hostage-taking more likely. In fact, of course, this was an exchange of prisoners between two belligerents in a war that has gone on in a traditional kind of prisoner exchange like this for millennia, and particularly at the close of conflicts. Bottom line requirement that this president feels is necessary is that he should leave no one of our soldiers behind on the battlefield. I think that's an obligation he felt and has, and that's exactly what he did. But you know, then they turned around and started attacking this guy's integrity and patriotism. Whatever mistakes he may have made 5 years ago that helped aid, if they did help aid his capture. The man has been there for 5 years in Taliban captivity, hopeless, in a situation that none of these critics can fathom. I mean, it's just unbelievable that they would attack this American prisoner of war upon his release. I just think it's a new low.
Well, apparently, according to the New York Times, these soldiers from Bergdahl's unit have literally were found by Republican strategists and handled and then handed over to the press on a plate. So that I've never known anything quite like that in a breaking news story where a political party injects an element into the story that's, in this case, obviously, is flagrantly designed to discredit the Obama administration.
Well, to discredit this soldier. Just think about it. These guys who, many of whom are straight-up chicken hawks, who promoted the worst foreign policy disasters in a generation in Iraq through lying to the American people, never served a moment in the military themselves, never saw a combat, sat over here with their chair in their easy chairs or fancy restaurants while other people fought their wars for them, criticizing this guy who's been in Taliban captivity for 5 years. If there is a problem with his behavior, that should be litigated by the American military, not by a bunch of Republican pundits. And if there is a need for some kind of discipline, or was at some point, it should be meted out by the American military, not by the Taliban.
Well, I think the American military have made it clear that if there is a case to be brought against Bergdahl for desertion or whatever, they will pursue it and look into it, which presumably they're doing now. There was a quote from an admiral in the Pentagon in regards to these questions raised by Republican operatives who have gone out and found members of Bergdahl's unit, and who the rest of the press, unfortunately, have dutifully printed what they've organized. This admiral said, I thought, rather on point. He said, look, if somebody falls off a ship, is pushed off a ship, or jumps off a ship, we still turn the ship around and find him. That's military code, isn't it?
That's exactly right. Talk about national security. I think it's important that every soldier or sailor or whatever who signs up understands that the United States of America has his or her back. And it's not going to abandon them because some talk show host argues that they've discovered that they aided in, by violating some rules, aided in their own capture or their own disappearance. That's outrageous. If shoe were on the other foot, if Democrats took the position they have with respect to a prisoner of war that President Bush had negotiated to release, they would accuse us of being the most unpatriotic people on earth. I just think it's despicable.
But my understanding, Robert Creamer, is that whenever there's a way of negotiating with the so-called axis of evil, people that we don't want to deal with, inevitably, when you get down to a negotiation, whether it's, say, with Iran or North Korea or, in this case, the Taliban, the first thing on the table is if they're holding an American hostage, and that's the deal breaker. You don't even get to the real deal until you get that off the table. And it seems so obvious to me that this deal, brokered by the Emir of Qatar, is about that. In other words, there's clearly, in fact, the Afghan press is full of stories now about alarm at the extent to which the U.S. and the Obama administration is engaged in negotiations with the Taliban. Clearly to me, particularly getting swapping these Taliban prisoners, many of whom are senior and close to Mullah Omar, this has a lot to do with a bigger deal that's coming down the pike, surely.
So I would think that's right. Beyond that, you negotiate with your adversaries. You don't negotiate with your friends. That's the point of, if you're in a conflict and you want to settle it, you negotiate with the people who are you're in the conflict with. Now, I personally have absolutely no use for the Taliban. I think their attitudes toward women and toward overall construction of society is primitive and disrespectful and something we've got to try and deal with. I'm not a Taliban sympathizer in the least, just the opposite. But on the other hand, if you're going to settle a conflict with somebody who's your adversary, that's who you negotiate with, not somebody else.
But in terms of the idea that the Republican operatives found some of these people from Bergdahl's platoon, Joshua Cornelson and Cody Full apparently were, their appearances to the media were arranged by Republican strategists. My understanding is that the main beef they have against Bergdahl is that he quite likely was, he certainly was AWOL, and he wandered off, and why he did it is not entirely clear. But their main complaint about him is that he caused casualties because they said for months afterwards they were looking for him and they walked into various Taliban ambushes. That's been pretty much debunked by the New York Times, who said, you know, that in effect the initial searches for him, there were no American casualties. But, you know, weeks later there were casualties, but largely because they were in a very hot region where the Taliban, and particularly in this case the Haqqani network, were active. So can the White House do anything about, you know, shooting these downs? If the press is so dutiful in printing stuff that's been arranged by Republican strategists, surely, where's the war room from the Clinton administration?
Well, I think I'm betting the White House is absolutely has the same attitude I have here in terms of what an outrage it is for folks to be attacking an American POW. And I would not be surprised if they don't put out some of these things that contravene that, and that the New York Times article may be partially a result of that. I would say this, you know, the facts of the matter are things to be litigated by an appropriate investigation, not by this kind of stuff. And it's this is an overt attempt to smear this man who's been in captivity for 5 years. I mean, think about that. I mean, don't you have better things to do than smear some poor young man who may have done something stupid? You know, that's where you don't go AWOL, because you're, you know, I mean, the guy who, it's not the first time that the deer that stays away from the pack or falls behind the pack is the one that gets cut out by the lion. You know, that's what happens. But the fact that he may have done something stupid is simply no justification for leaving him in Taliban activity for the rest of his life. I mean, captivity for the rest of his life. What an outrage! Is that what they propose? I mean, this is, as you say, this is part of the Obama derangement syndrome. Anything that the president does, these people basically, want to attack. It has infected right-wing pundits to the point that it's led them to what I think is a very dark place for them, and that is simply now over the top. I think this will be rejected by ordinary Americans because of its outrageous, unprecedented kind of tone, and because they're basically, you know, it reminds you of the shameful way that America treated returning Vietnam veterans almost a half century ago. And that's something we've tried very hard, progressives have tried very hard not to repeat. Those soldiers are brave, patriotic Americans doing what the country asked them to do. And if there's something wrong with the war, it's because the decision makers sent them there. And some of the same decision makers that sent them there are the people who are immediately ready to carp about these kind of decisions when, frankly, I don't know why any of these people should be taken seriously at all. They are some of the most, made some of the most tragic errors that killed, you're talking about killing people. They killed hundreds of thousands of people with their decision to go into Iraq. What an outrage that they should even have anything to say about this.
Well, of course, not only is Fox News beating the drum against Bergdahl, they're also going after his father, Bob, who apparently, in sympathy with his captive son, grew a beard and learned Arabic. I mean, it's bad enough going after Bergdahl, now they're going after his father, for God's sake. I mean,
think about it. Let's go after the grieving parents of a warrior who has been captured by the other side. Unbelievable. Whatever they do, geez. I mean, these people, you know, and they have struggled barely for 5 years, what the reports say, to try and keep his captivity before the American people so that they could get their son home. I mean, you know, aren't these people parents, a lot of them?
So what's your sense then, Robert Creamer, of how this is going to play out in the midterms? Obviously, today's an important day in terms of primaries around the country, and Mississippi and Iowa, and of course in California. And I'm not sure what the narratives are on both sides, both on the Democratic side and the Republican side, except, you know, we were expecting that Obamacare would be the narrative. The Republicans seem to be backing away from that. Benghazi is the other narrative. So far, there's no there, pending some kind of miracle or, you know, Moses returning with the tablets. I don't think that's ever going to materialize. What do you think the Republicans are going to run on?
I mean, here's the thing. All of these things are aimed at mobilizing. This is meat for the Republican base. And it helps them raise money. I mean, they don't do it. They're not stupid to do this from the point of view of their own kind of very particular self-interest, raising money, pandering to the narrow right-wing base that they want to turn out in this fall's election. When it comes to persuadable voters, I don't think these things will have any impact at all. I mean, domestic issues, particularly the economic question of whether we're going to raise the wages of ordinary Americans, will be at the center. Things like immigration will be at the center of turnout for our base. Things like, do they respect African Americans? Do they respect women? These guys do they respect immigrant Americans? But I think that will help determine whether or not large numbers of people turn out in this race. In general, I'm more optimistic, by the way, than a lot of people. And the reason is because, there's a 3 to 5% greater reduction in Democratic turnout than Republican turnout in off years. And that can have a direct impact on the outcome of elections. But that's enough. We can do something about 3 to 5%. It's not 20%. It's something we can do a lot about by talking to people about why we're not going to get off their porch until they vote. It's something we can do a lot about by talking about how we've got to kind of show people that the other side can't disrespect us if we're African Americans or immigrants or women or ordinary workers that are paid $7.25 an hour by people who make $25,000 an hour. And I think this is about respect, this election, and it's about whether we raise the wages of ordinary Americans. And if we talk about those things, I think we have a decent shot at certainly holding our own, and I hope winning both the Senate and potentially taking back the House.
Well, it seems, though, that this stuff over the Bergdahls, and particularly going after the family, is sort of the last gasp of the culture wars because, you know, Bergdahl isn't your traditional military family type. You know, he's got a beard, and apparently he's made no secret of his opposition to U.S. military aggression, which is a lot of Americans feel that way. But it seems to me that... exactly. The vast majority are very happy that the U.S. is getting out of Afghanistan. And also, it was a majority of Americans who forced Obama's hand in terms of getting involved in Syria. So,
and most Americans do not want another war in the Middle East. And if the Republicans think they can make an issue about doing another war in the Middle East, I think that is a suicidal kind of undertaking from their point of view.
But I'm suggesting here that because the Bergdahls don't fit into the traditional straight-laced American military family waving flags, they seem like they're fair game for the right-wing press. And the thing that's shameful about this is how the mainstream press has dutifully printed all of this stuff condemning Sergeant Bergdahl that has been arranged by Republican operatives. That's the
problem. I agree with that. I would say I was watching CNN last night, and that's what got me to write this article. These guys, act like people who talk about negotiating for hostages and are legitimate voices, and that's just outrageous. I mean, but I think normal people can see through a lot of that, and it's incumbent upon progressives certainly to stand up proudly and not be defensive about this or Benghazi or any of these things, and just make it clear what we believe is really going on and how outrageous these things are. And to go right to the values, I mean, this is about whether we leave soldiers behind. This is not about any of this other stuff. And the election upcoming is about respect. It's about our wages. It's about whether people have work full-time, live in poverty. I mean, it's about those kind of principled issues. If we stick to that, I think we have a good a good odds of overcoming the kind of mainstream press complicity in this kind of thing and breaking through.
And presumably the military families, and particularly those serving in the military, get it because they know what's going on here. And if any of their sons and daughters in the service were ever captured, they know that the U.S. will move heaven and earth to get them back. And that's a part of the deal, and that's what this is all really all about. So the rest of them really are shameful. I thank you for joining us, Robert Creamer.
It's very good to be with you. Thank you for your wonderful radio program. Thanks, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Robert Creamer, who's a longtime political organizer and strategist and the author of Stand Up Straight, How Progressives Can Win. He is a partner in Democracy Partners and a senior strategist for Americans United for Change. And he has an article at the Huffington Post, The Despicable Republican Attack on an American Prisoner of War. We're going to take a brief station break and be back with a former Beijing-based foreign correspondent who covered the Tiananmen Square massacre 25 years ago.
I hope he's right in the head. I hope he's right in the head. I hope he's right in the head, even if he had to wrong someone. I hope he's right in the head. I hope he's right in the head. I hope he's right in the head, even if he had to wrong someone.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Scott Savitt, who's a former Beijing-based foreign correspondent for the Los Angeles Times and United Press International. He is a visiting scholar at Duke University, and his forthcoming memoir is on his two decades as an American reporter in China. Welcome to Background Briefing, Scott Savitt.
Thank you, Ian.
And clearly there's a media blackout in China itself. It's now morning in China on the June 4th, they apparently have been pretty effective. There are more plainclothesmen on Tiananmen Square than there are tourists, they've obviously detained an awful lot of political activists, artists, lawyers, and other government critics before this 25th anniversary. And even a French film crew were nailed. Had their film confiscated and had to actually appear on television in an apology. So the government is being pretty sensitive about this, but my understanding is that they basically eradicated most of the memories. So why are they so paranoid if we are to believe reports that in China most people have either forgotten it or too young to know about it?
Well, don't believe everything you hear about it being so effectively eradicated. Certainly, you know, it's 25 years, so there's a large portion of the population that wasn't born yet. But there's a piece on the front page of the New York Times today that points out how much dissent there was even in the military about that crackdown. And the thing about June 4th, 1989 is that it's still the one thing that could be used by a faction in the government. And if they could pin the blame for that on someone else, then that's just, it's remained a political hot potato. You might have the impression that, it's self-evident. If it didn't have weight, then why would it remain so sensitive 25 years later?
Well, the thing about the incident itself, which seems to be forgotten, is the the politics of what was happening prior to it. My recall, and you were there, so just correct me if I get it wrong, but Hu Yaobang had died, and his funeral became a kind of magnet for the student movement because they admired him, and that the Chinese president at the time, Zhao Zheng, was actually a liberal, quite a progressive guy, and he was reluctant to do anything about it and became under more and more pressure from the hardliners as this thing dragged on and as the students appeared on television haranguing their elders, etc. And eventually they got rid of forced Zhao Zheng out, and then the hardliners took over and made this decision, which, as you point out in the New York Times, some of the generals were unhappy about, particularly the major general in charge of the 38th Division. So just tell us about the politics. You were there before that, because what it leaves you the impression with, Scott, is the idea that China could have liberalized a lot earlier. You know, they could have had the Chinese Gorbachev back then, but for this incident and how the Iraq reactionaries took over.
Well, that is the revisionist history, and you know, there are no do-overs in history. But everything that you just said is essentially accurate. But yeah, there were pre-existing circumstances. Well, the most important thing by far is, 1989, the reforms had already been underway for close to a decade. And, even though it wasn't the economy that it is today, I lived in China. I reported in China throughout the entire decade of the 1980s, and the transformation was tremendous already. And what they were trying to do was unravel the damage that Mao had done. And one of the things they were trying to do, very controversial, was remove price controls on everything. I mean, there were, I myself used ration coupons throughout most of that decade, and they were doing away with it. And when you remove price controls, prices tend to rise. So there was pretty debilitating inflation. The thing they call corrupt officials, in the Chinese term for it is corrupt profiteering, and it's literally the verb that means to arbitrage. So if you're a Communist Party official, you can get the state price on, any scarce resource and then turn around and sell it on the market for twice the price. And this is what Communist Party officials were doing, obscenely enriching themselves, and people were really angry about it. So when Hu Yaobang died on April 15th, 1989, the students saw it as an opportunity. And, I lived right down the street from our UPI office, was right down the street from Tiananmen Square. So, I remember when the people first came into the square and started putting up these white funerary wreaths. And if you know Chinese history, the last time that happened was after the popular premier Zhou Enlai died. And that was the original Tiananmen incident in 1976. And that it's extremely sensitive. And because there was a stalemate between the hardline faction and the moderate faction in the party, no one was willing to give the order to crack down. And the first day there were 100 people, and the next day there were 1 million people in Tiananmen Square. And that was it. Then you were going to have a real difficult time getting them out. And they continued to occupy that square for the next 7 weeks. There's still a dispute about what actually took place. But my conclusion is, the hardliners actually used this as an opportunity to oust their liberal rival, and it was essentially a palace coup that didn't even accord with Communist Party constitutional principles. They actually, to oust the Communist Party General Secretary, they should have convened in a large meeting of the National People's Congress, so they didn't accord. And a lot of people think that, they're the Communist Party, they can do anything they want. But actually, they always try to accord with their own internal procedures, if at all possible. So there were a lot of extraordinary things. And what this New York Times reporting, the significance of it is it reveals that there was a lot more dissent than people realized. And that I told somebody today, I said, this gives you a glimpse of when this stuff, and I believe it's when, not if, when it's reevaluated, this is the story that's going to be told, because the People's Liberation Army, you know, they were humiliated by this. They got blood on their hands. And sooner or later, this is going to be pinned on somebody. Maybe after the principals are all dead, they're, you know, some of them are still alive. But, you know, if too much more time passes, then probably those guys will pass from the scene. But I do believe that this will go down in history as a tragic mistake and still may be the nail in the coffin of the Communist Party of China.
Well, of course, it's pretty hard to believe that the nail in the coffin wasn't hammered in decades ago because of the insanity of Mao Zedong. The Cultural Revolution was so unbelievably destructive. And of course, the modernization, everybody had a kiln in their backyard making useless steel, and the country was starving. The insanity of what went on. I imagine after that was over, there was a huge sigh of relief. You just feel that country just has been tortured for so long, either by foreign occupiers and by mad emperors, and then this Mao and his crazy actress wife, etc. So is that what's your sense of how much they've struggled?
Well, it's been a quite traumatic century. Here we are, a little more than 100 years after the fall of the Qing dynasty, and very, very tumultuous. Now, the communists, the one thing that Mao was actually popular in the early years after the revolution because they were able to bring order to a country that had been riven by war and, foreign invasion and civil war throughout the entire first half of the 20th century. So the communists come in and they're considered clean by previous standards, but of course they go back to the same old crazy ways. And as you pointed out, Mao, his economic policies were a disaster. So when he died, and Deng Xiaoping took over in the late 1970s, really what China, a lot of people don't realize, they call it the economic miracle. There's no miracle whatsoever. For the last 30 years, certainly impressive growth, but if you average it out over the 65 years that the communists have been in power, it's extremely average. And actually what you would expect for a post-war reconstruction, which is what's taken place in the last 30 years, because there was no post-war reconstruction under Mao. They've crammed it all into 3 decades. Now they're recognizing that there have been huge environmental costs and social costs, and people are very, very dissatisfied. And that's how you understand this, why the party is so sensitive to anniversary. Essentially, I can tell you, you're going to wake up one day and there's going to be people back in the streets in China. And, the question is, how would the government respond this time? I have no doubt that they would give the order to fire again, but I do have doubt whether the military would carry it out. And that's what gives them sleepless nights.
And, of course, the irony was just in terms of the difference between what unraveled the Soviet Union and has, in effect, kept China together is that Gorbachev had glasnost, which was meant to stimulate perestroika, glasnost meaning what comes off the tip of your tongue, freeing people to talk about the system. The idea, of course, was to improve the system, but it effectively suddenly exposed that the emperor had no clothes. And the Chinese have done the opposite. They've allowed perestroika, but not glasnost. But what I remember at the time of Tiananmen, guess who showed up? None other than Gorbachev, right?
Exactly. Yeah, it was the Sino-Soviet summit was the reason that the entire world press was there. Our bureau had, you know, bureau chiefs coming in from all over the place just to cover that event, because that was the first summit since Mao met Stalin. So that was, you know, significant in and of itself. And then you have the perfect storm of student protesters occupying the center of your capital.
And Gorbachev basically said, you know, they're out to lunch or something. I mean, he wasn't particularly helpful from my recollection.
Well, you know, you could tell. I covered his visit and, you know, spent time right around him. And you could tell that he was sympathetic to what the students were saying, because it was the same thing that he was saying in his system. And, you know, the attempt was, can you... There's an old Chinese saying, you know, it's ascribed to Deng Xiaoping, but it probably even dates back earlier. And they say, you know, if we don't address the rot in the system, then we're going to lose the party. But if we do address the rot in the system, then we're going to lose the country. So, or vice versa. I apologize. So, in other words, you're damned if you do and damned if you don't. And it's a very slippery slope. So, even though China has loosened up the economic reins and not the political system, you know, sooner or later you hit a point where there's an emerging middle class in China, and you know, the general perception is people do not want things to continue. You know, a lot of times you'll hear it said that people are satisfied with the way things are. Do not believe that. It's simply not true. You know, people cite opinion polls. Chinese people don't tell what they really think to strangers taking surveys. So, you know, I stay in close contact with Chinese people all day, every day, and they are not happy with the way things are. And, you know, they finally do want that glasnost to go along with the perestroika, and are increasingly demanding it in all kinds of ways. You know, a lot of the successful protests are are environmental protests. So,
sure.
You have a very effective NIMBY movement at present, and people realize, go out in numbers and get, you know, polluting industry moved, and that's
right.
That's the beginning of of affected political activism.
Well, Scott Savitt, I'm afraid we've run out of time, but I thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, no problem, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Scott Savitt, who's a former Beijing-based foreign correspondent for the Los Angeles Times and United Press International. He's a visiting scholar at Duke University, and his forthcoming memoir is on his 2 decades as an American reporter in China. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.